following interview was conducted with Tom Bacher, the director of University Press, on Thursday, July 24, 2008, for the Purdue University Oral History Program. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, the Oral History Librarian. Welcome. Tell us where you were born and your parents and early years.
I was actually born in Nagoya, Japan. My father was in the Air Force after World War II. He had met my mother in Germany prior to that. They'd moved to the States, and then he was stationed in Japan. After spending a very few years, I think 2 years in Japan, we moved to Duluth, Minnesota, which was another Air Force base at the time. And that's when he retired after 25 years in the Air Force. Then we moved to Ohio, and that's where I spent most of my years from, I think it was six, till I graduated from college.
Tell us a little bit about high school, what that was like, and then move on to college.
Yeah, I went to a parochial grade school, 1 through 8, called St. Bridget's in Parma, Ohio. And then I went on to high school at Valley Forge High School in Parma Heights, Ohio. And I must say that I learned a lot from 1 through 8, so high school years were pretty easy for me. I don't know if I enjoyed my high school years as much as I did my college years, but they were still somewhat fun doing some things in high school. And then I went on to a small liberal arts school called Hiram College.
How did you happen to select that? And tell us a little bit about campus life and...
I selected it because I had a mentor in high school, a history teacher. I was in the advanced placement program in history, and he recommended that I go there. And so I didn't know a whole bunch. My parents had never gone to college, so my sister had right before me. She was 3.5 years older than I am. And basically I chose that college because of his recommendation, went through a visit, I liked it a lot. I did a lot of things. I debated in college. I was a DJ at the radio station. I played golf. I was a history and German major. And I really enjoyed it. I think it was a wonderful experience.
Did you live on campus?
I lived on campus. There was no way to live off campus those days. I lived in some dorms. And I also was, they created a house called the History House for history majors that lasted a few years, and I was one of the first people to live in that house on campus. But I thought the community was very nice and the atmosphere.
How large was the campus approximately? How many were you?
Their students were about 1,000 students, I think. Uh-huh. Split up pretty evenly across 4 classes. The town of Hiram is a very small town. They had, I think, well, they did have a post office, but I know there was not a bar in town when I was there. And I don't think there was a grocery store either in town when I was there. You had to drive a few miles away to get some things like that. So it was very enclosed in a small campus.
Yeah, okay. Then what year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1978.
Okay, and then tell us what was next.
I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I had an offer to go to Kent State University to work in the political science program. I have a master's in political science. I was a TA.
At
Kent State, yeah. And so that lasted, I think, another 2 years. So about 1980, I got a master's degree from Kent State. And then after that, I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I didn't want to go to school anymore and because I was sort of tired of going to school. My sister at the time was living in New York City. She was working for the Department of Commerce there, and I moved to New York City in the early 80s. And I tried to get a job in New York City. It took a while. I first worked at the basement of Macy's department store on Herald Square. I worked in the deli. So I know a lot about meats, cheeses, and fish because of all the experience I had there, which I thought was fascinating. And I learned a whole bunch about customer service because of the people I work with, and they had to deal with a lot of different types of folks who came to buy pâté, which was not inexpensive, or cuts of meat, which were not inexpensive. And it was a rather fascinating experience. I really enjoyed it, as a matter of fact. And a little bit after that, I finally got a job in a publishing company. I write, and I still like to write, and I thought that's what writers do, but I don't think that's what writers do. Writers write, and if you're going to work in publishing, you probably don't want to be, or it makes it more difficult to be a writer. But I got a job at a place called Plenum Publishing, which was a science publishing company on Spring Street in New York.
Yeah, the village.
The southern part of sort of Soho, right off the edge of Soho, 233 Spring Street. I remember the address still. I don't think it's there anymore at that location. I think the company was sold. But I became a production editor, and that's how I got my start in publishing in New York.
What did that entail? What sort of job? What was that job?
It was prior to computers being in place on the desktop, so we actually had to review materials that were typeset to make sure that changes had been made, that everything looked good, there were no missing words, or some of the material just didn't get it printed right. And if we had to make changes, we used X-Acto knives to cut out words or letters, and we used X-Acto knives and wax and things like that to paste words and letters back into the materials. So we were very good at doing that. We called ourselves word surgeons because of that. But it's a far cry from what happens today because of the nature of publishing and how computers have changed that greatly, especially that part of the process.
Right. Yeah. Were you working with the galley proofs then?
Yes, working with galleys and page proofs. Did both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Worked there for several years, and then I moved to another publishing company called Longman, whose offices were in Times Square, in the same building as the Actors' Equity facilities. And I remember clearly about that building because there were a lot of auditions that would happen in that building up on the upper floors. And all the elevators in the building had mirrors in them so that the actors that were coming in to audition could make sure they looked good before they went up there. I may have seen some future stars, but I don't think I would have known about it at that point in time. So I worked there for several years.
How did you like living in New York? Were you married at that time?
No, single in New York. I think it's a good time to go to New York if you're going to go to New York while you're young. It was a very a difficult process economically. Costs were pretty high. I shared an apartment, but the nice thing was there was a lot of the people I work with in the publishing companies were in the same boat, so we got together to do things. And there's a lot of things you can do in New York that don't cost a lot of money once you figure out what's going on there. And with the community of the friends, you know, we did a lot of things together, like played softball and did some other sporting activities, went to events together, went out together. You tend to find the places that are sort of more local, not off the beaten path, but just not in the areas where most tourists go to, and so you can live there. It was fun. I mean, it was a very educational part of my life. I learned, you know, from growing up basically in the Midwest, I learned a lot of other lessons when I moved to New York, and I think that was great.
Right. Okay. So that's your career path, and then.
I worked at Longman. Then the next job I got was at Cambridge University Press, and that was in New York City. It used to be on 57th Street between Park and Madison. There are offices, and that was a rather swanky area, still is, for a publishing company to have offices there. I think they had gotten a lease, a long time before that, and it was very nice. And then after I worked at, but during the time I was there, they moved to 20th Street between 5th and 6th in New York. And that was in a different area, but they moved their offices down there. I worked there for about 6 years. That's where I met my wife. She was working there. And during that period of time, I got married. And we moved out to Connecticut, to Norwalk, Connecticut. I was still working at Cambridge for a period of that time, for a few years. And then I moved to another publishing company, which was right next door in Westport, Connecticut, called Greenwood Publishing. And I worked there for several years, and I'd worked in different roles in different companies. Cambridge, I became sort of the database manager because computers had just started to come in, and I built their databases, their informational databases, their marketing databases. And then when I moved over to Greenwood, I was a director of systems and operations, and we put in some networks and things like that. And then I worked at a place in Armonk, New York called Emmy Sharp after that. That was my last job before coming to Purdue, and I was a director of marketing and sales there. And then in 1997, in January of 1997, January 6th to be exact, I started at Purdue University Press.
How did you hear about the position? Was it advertised?
Yeah, the position was advertised, and it had been sort of a goal. I wanted to become a director of university press, and Purdue at the time was a rather small university press. And I remember clearly coming out on the interview, doing phone interview first. I don't remember the phone interview as much, but I do clearly remember coming out and interviewing with A.G. Rudd, who was the chair of the search committee, I think, when he was over in education, and sort of walking the campus and making the rounds. I was unaccustomed working in the commercial sector to coming and meeting with so many people in 2 days of interviews, from the editorial board to all kinds of different faculty members to some administrators to the dean of libraries, those sorts of things. And I was lucky enough to get the job.
Okay, then we move on. So tell us what the responsibilities and the mission as director of the press, and then some of the acceptance routines and the peer review.
Sure.
And your board.
Yeah, the press mission is to primarily disseminate scholarly information in a variety of fields, depending on what the focus of the press is. At Purdue, we sort of switched the editorial program to be one where we would do it in the health area, especially Alzheimer's, some technologies areas. We had a little line of business materials that we've done. And we've also maintained other areas that were here. When I first got here, we did a series in Central European studies, a series in Romance literatures, a series in comparative cultural studies, and we've also developed a journals program.
Yeah, the series, have they had more than when you first came?
Yeah, we expanded the series by probably two or three fold. By using some faculty members here and elsewhere to allow them to be series editors. One of the newer series we have is called Philosophy Communications, which is sort of a cross between communications and philosophy, which was a series that started probably about 2 years ago, and we have four books in that series with a few more coming out shortly. Basically, a university press makes sure by getting the materials reviewed by peers of those that write the books to make sure that they add academic worth and content to the discussion. So if we have a history book in European studies, for example, we'll find some outside reviewers who are most likely faculty members at other institutions to review the materials and make sure that we're doing everything correctly and that the materials and books are worthy of publication. After that, before we can publish any materials at the university press, we have a faculty board, an editorial board of 9 faculty members, and we have to present the proposals to that board. This is not atypical of Purdue University Press, but happens in all the university presses. And the faculty board has to approve the project before they finally get published. And then at that point in time, if we get approval from them, we can contract with the authors and then put them in the manufacturing process.
Okay.
So that's what we do. When I first got here, we were probably doing 6 to 10 books a year. We're doing between 25 and 30 books a year now without an increase in staff. There's been some reasons that could be done with outsourcing and the like. And we've set it up because we don't have an acquisitions editor per se at the Purdue University Press. That's a person that would go out and find projects. At most university presses, there are acquisitions editors. So since we didn't have one, we decided that it was better to set up a whole set of series where those editors could then go ahead and acquire materials for us. And that's in place. So we have a lot of materials that are in process, that are always in process. And so we have the necessary content to publish on any given year. Amount of books.
The board has approval, but is it by consensus or majority?
It's majority.
Okay.
Most things are done by consensus, though. I would say that there are a few projects where there will be some questions on the value of the book. Perhaps we may have to get another review from an outside source. But for the most part, the board provides consensus on those, but it doesn't have to. It's just a simple majority if the book is being published or not.
Right. Okay. What about budget and marketing?
Budget. Well, I always think that the press gets a budget.
Is that from the
university? That's right. The university budgets and gives the press enough for the press's salaries and a small supply and expense budget. The press then also sells, obviously, its content, and has to pay for all the production, all the other necessary things, including the marketing out of that particular stream of revenue. And the budget probably is, as always, most people would say they need more money. And I think it's probably true. Probably more staff at the press would be helpful. We've done quite a bit with the small staff that we have, being kind of smart about outsourcing materials, deciding.
Where's your production done?
We do.
Is that outsourced?
If we the printing of the books,
right, okay,
themselves is done outside of the university. There's no facility here at the university that could do that. It's done mostly at a place in Ohio. There are not many book printers in Indiana that would deal with sort of shorter run printing, which means we don't. We do 1,000 copies of a book, 300 copies of a book,
mm-hmm,
depending on what the book is. So we need a certain type of printer to make that feasible. So we don't do that here. And most of our marketing is outsourced too, where we deal with a group that markets our books and we pay them percentage on sales, 10% on net sales.
Is the covers designed in-house or the
Yeah, we do most of the books. Covers are designed in-house. We not only use some of our staff members that do that, I've even designed book covers, and the production manager designs books covers, but also we hire students every year. There will be between 2 and 5 students. Some of them will be interns from a program at the university, and we allow them to do a lot of book cover design depending on what their skill set is. So we actually, a lot of our covers are designed by students.
That's good. What about Notabell? That's a kind of an eclectic collection of your non-traditional classics.
Notabell is we have a few imprints, which sort of distinguishes our books from one another. Notabell is a collection of books that we have decided we'd like to target to the bookstore market. So they're priced, their paperbacks priced under $15 for the most part. And so we've done books that perhaps would fit in that, so that some of the books might be, I think one of the books in that series is The Letters of George Ade, possibly another book in that series was the Diary of an Engineer in Central America in the early 1900s. There's sort of books sort of like that. I think there was a John Perdue biography that was also in that series. We wanted to call it Bell Tower Books because of the bell tower at Purdue, but that was taken by another company, so that's why we changed it to Notabell Books instead of Bell Tower Books. We have two other imprints that I know of for sure. We have one imprint called Pup Books, P-U-P Books, which is an imprint that where we reprint books from the early 1900s, adventures books for juveniles. We've done the Airplane Boy books and Airplane Girl books, and we've done a series of Boy Hunter books, I think, in that series. And we also have a set of books called I-Corp Business Books, where we've done, where we partitioned those off too, where they're books that we've done in the area of call centers and those things in cooperation with some folks here. But we've also done some things outside of the normal scope of that, so that imprints allow you to delineate in marketing what the particular book's traits are.
I see. And just a couple comments on your journals. One, of course, is that shofar journal that you might just make. You've added journals, have you, since you've
Yeah, added? We, I don't know if we did it with a complete program plan in mind. Initially, we were approached by the folks that were doing shofar and ask if we might...
Excuse me, for the researchers, that was in-house, it was a Purdue publication, am I correct?
It comes out of the Jewish Studies program.
Which is a Purdue program.
Purdue program, that's correct. Okay. It was being published out of the University of Nebraska at the time that they came to us. University of Nebraska decided that they didn't want to do some journalists anymore. So we contracted with the program here to do that journal. So we've done that journal now for, I'd say, 4 years or so. And as we got that journal, we found some other things that came along with it. We have several journals now, I think 8 or 9 of them, 4 or 5 are open access journals. We have the open access journals are First Opinion, Second Reactions, which is a journal of reviews of K-12 literature, not only initial reviews, but then the editors go back and seek out an educator that used the book in the classroom, and they tell us exactly what happened in that situation. We have something called CLC Web, which is Comparative Culture and Literature, which has been going on for 10 years, which is an open access journal that talks about comparative cultural studies, mostly, well, it's world, it's global, so that has worked for us. We also have a journal called Journal of Problem Solving, which is at the Department of Psychology at Purdue, which talks about problem solving is based on the salesman's problem and how to go from point to point, which is done much easier than if you do it through a computer repetition. It takes a computer a long, long time to do it, and somehow the mind works better in doing those things, and that's the basis of that. And the Interdisciplinary Journal of Problem-Based Learning, which is also a Purdue journal. And then we also have the Journal of Terrestrial Observations, which is an open access journal at this point in time. And we have a few other journals, too, that go along with that that aren't open access. Education and Culture, which is a journal of the John Dewey Society. We have called the Studies in America, Jewish Life in America. And we also have Studies in Jewish American Literature. And we just contracted this year to pick up Philip Roth Studies. So we have a rather large collection of journals that just sort of happened over the last 4 or so years in certain areas. So we've been very lucky in those that respect.
For the researchers who are going to be looking at it, could you just make a comment on what's open access? So just
Open access is a... is sort of a philosophy that says that there are two types of journals. Subscription model journals means that people pay for access to those journals, but it's closed, meaning that it may be accessible to a library like the Purdue Library, but it's usually guarded by IP, so that you have to have an IP address that's a Purdue IP address to get access to that. And the open access model is a little bit different. It means that the materials, sometimes in open access, there's several varieties. One variety says you pay for the article before publication, the researcher does, after acceptance. Or in some ways, it's basically there's no costs, and the organization that's publishing bears the costs, like the press. But what it does is that once the article is published, it's freely available to anyone in the world via web access. So it's a way to distribute information more broadly than it is for subscription-based models. So there's both those models sort of being in play right now, and open access is starting to gain a lot more credence because universities understand that they pay for their researchers to do research, and then they buy the research back from some subscription-based products. And so the idea is, on the open access, it might decrease the total cost of the system of research.
Right. One of the things that you did was that meet the authors for the Purdue authors.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the first time that it had been done?
I don't know if it's the first time it's been done, but I think the program we did, because we had we had five or so authors at a particular event that we've done at a local bookstore prior to the holidays usually. And I think that the number of authors and at that event was probably unusual to have, because usually book signings, there's sort of one author, but we did a lot of them.
Yeah, that's very good. Okay. Tell us about membership in the American Association of University Presses.
The Purdue University Press is a member of the association, American University Presses. We pay an annual fee to be a member. And the organization itself is sort of a sponsorship organization for the university presses, and it's global, it's not just American. And they basically take the cause of university presses and try to let people know about them. If there's financial questions, operational questions, they can answer those for you. They try to promote university presses, and the importance of university presses is sort of a primary
mm-hmm.
Goal of that particular organization. I think there are about 120 members to that organization. There aren't a lot of university presses worldwide, as opposed to how many universities there are, but there are a number of them.
Okay. Book fairs, you've gone to some of those. Make a couple comments on those.
Sure.
Both national and international, right?
Yeah, my favorite book fair to go to is the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is in Frankfurt, Germany, every year at the beginning of October. And it's not that it's a trip to Germany that makes it my favorite, it's just that it's the largest book fair in the world, where everyone...
It's a long, old one, too.
It's very old, yes. I think the Leipzig Book Fair, which used to happen, and then when there was the Soviet Union and East Germany, it didn't happen as readily before. Leipzig is older than Frankfurt,
mm-hmm.
but Frankfurt is one of the oldest book fairs in the world. And everyone comes to that book fair. It's a book fair that's different because it's a business meeting where publishers go and buy and sell rights to their books. So rights for translation, English editions in different countries, those sorts of things. I mean, for a university press, it makes some sense to go there, as we've gone, because we can sell rights and we can find out what's going on in the industry, which is very, very important. And without that, I don't think the press would have gotten as far along as it has. But there are, you have to understand, there's some major vendors there that are selling rights, like the companies that own the rights to Mickey Mouse, for example, sell the rights there. So that it's a very high profile, high deal oriented. And the public doesn't get to come in until the book fair lasts, I think, 5 days, and they don't get to come in until the last 2 days. So it's all business to business meetings.
Sure.
I think that's the best one. I've also got a Book Exhibit of America, which is the American equivalent of that, which used to be a very important fair when there were a lot of independent booksellers in the United States. But over the last 10 or so years, the booksellers have diminished as an independence, as big changes have come up. So it's not as important, but people still go there. It's usually in three cities in the U.S. It's in New York, or it's in Chicago, or it's in L.A. And it's okay, but it's still... It's not as important a fair anymore as it used to be. And those are sort of the primary two fairs that I go to. I go to some other exhibits that are more subject related, like a Communications Association of America or the Modern Language Association, on irregular basis as I go to those, depending on where they are. because we have some books in those areas, and it's very important sort of to be on display, just because you meet the end buyers at those things.
Sure, that's right, yeah. Purdue Press, tell us about being on Good Morning America, how that came about, and also the New Yorker, make a comment on that.
Yeah, we have a book called Creating Moments of Joy. We've had the book in our collection, it's in its fourth edition, so we started publishing it, I would say, 8 years ago. It was done by...
Was it originally done here?
Yes, it's originally done here. It is a book on providing information to people that deal with Alzheimer's patients on how to create small moments of joy. For example, if there's a photograph that your father liked, and you can show that photograph, and there can be some reminiscence about that. And of course, that person will forget about it, you know, in a few minutes or so, but it provides that feeling, good feeling for everyone involved with it for a small amount of time. And the woman that, her name is Jolene Brakey, who is the author of that book, has worked sort of diligently and provides seminars and things like that. And earlier this month, she was on Good Morning America talking about the book. And I think it's great for her and great for the press that that had happened. And it's just wonderful because the book is probably our biggest selling book that we've had. I don't know how many copies it sold over the years and iterations, but it continues to sell. And we saw probably 2 or 3 years ago sort of a spike in sales, sort of reached a critical point where people started talking about the book, which is the way that things end up getting sold, the most effective way. And those people started buying the book more and more and more. And so it's now a perennial good seller for us. And I think her reputation and the book then got the attention of those producers at Good Morning America, and they invited her on, and she was on. It was rather interesting to see her on. And then we've done this book, which is called New York's Poop Scoop Law, Dogs, the Dirt, and Due Process. And it's a sort of a social history of how New York passed a law to make dog owners clean up after their pets. It's not just dog owners, but primarily dog owners. And the social process of that, the legal process, and also the sort of cultural process of what sort of devices were created in order to make that easier. And we got into recently, it's been was written about in the New Yorker magazine. It'll be in the New York Times. It's going to be on. It's going to be in the New York Post. I'm sure it'll get play in some other places too because of that. So it's been a rather fascinating thing that those two things have sort of come about. A lot of hard work from all my staff to get it done.
Good. How about let's take a look at university presses in the 21st century. Can you make a couple observations on that?
Yeah. Well, I think the Purdue University Press is in a sort of a good position. Because it's small, staff-wise, too. A lot of university presses are heavy in their production department because they've been book producers all their lives. And so that a physical book, has been what they've been doing. Much more of what's happening now is moving, of course, to the digital side of things. And that means there's a lot more e-books and a lot more content that's not... Really, I'm not saying the book's going to go away, but there's a lot more content in different areas that need to be addressed. And also, the press at Purdue and the libraries have a good cooperation of how that works, and I think that's great because a lot of the information that's at the university doesn't need to come out in book format, but it does need a process of being edited and formatted in a way that's retrievable over time. So I think presses, it's good to be small at this point in time, much more nimble, because you can take advantage of some of the opportunities that happen in those eras. And I think that what's basically coming about now is that people, the end user, is saying, I want the material in this format. It could be a book, it could be a digital e-book, it could be just a piece of the material, it could be a sort of a selection of materials. And I think the presses have to be able to provide that material. it's not the other way around. We don't push the content to them anymore in the way that we think is best for them. I think they pull it off the way they want to. And that could be cause some economic problems as new models are being built to accommodate that. But there's always going to be the necessity to distribute research no matter where it is at the university. And I think the cooperation
that's what they exist for.
Right, that's right. That's what they're supposed to, especially a land grant institute.
Right.
So, you know, there's the universities, I keep saying this, the universities that have university presses and that use them wisely to help them out in that process are far ahead of universities that don't. And so that it's a very important thing. And I think it's got to be a collaborative process now. It's got to be between, you know, IT, the libraries, the press, faculty members, and eventually you'll build up this resource that's very important for the university and its prestige.
Right. Do you have a favorite Purdue tradition? And I also ask an outstanding event. You can take both of those if you wish.
Outstanding. Well, I can tell you the outstanding event for me is very easy to remember. And it's sort of a funny, it's not funny, but it's sort of somewhat reminiscent for me because I came on board the same year Joe Tiller came on board to coach the football team. And I remember the first season of that, they played Toledo, a MAC team, and lost. And the second game was against Notre Dame at home. And this was the first football game I was going to watch Purdue play, and I thought, oh, gee whiz, they're going to get pounded. Well, it was one of the most exciting games. I went with my son, who was probably 7 at the time. And it was the first big football game he saw, too. And it was just fascinating. And I remember, you know, how Purdue came back and won the game. And it was just like, and Purdue at that time, you know, the team hadn't been doing that well for several years. So the fans, I don't think this, well, it was Notre Dame game, so I think the stadium was probably pretty full. A lot of Notre Dame fans in that game. But it was just the most remarkable comeback and most exciting game I remember ever seeing at the university. So that, as an event, I think that sort of was a nice start-up to my time at Purdue. So I thought that was just absolutely fascinating, you know, to see that happen. Purdue tradition, I think I learned the Purdue sort of fight song, and I think that's probably my favorite because I did go to some sporting events and things like that. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of other traditions. We've done a book on traditions at Purdue, and there's a lot of great history at Purdue that I think hadn't been collected for quite a long time, you know, sort of just sort of was put away places that people didn't know about. And you know, there's been a real resurgence in doing that. And I think that, you know, there's some fascinating things people don't really know that really happened, you know, at the university. And I think it's important as a historical record to have those things. And people do care about, you know, the sort of the traditions. Not that all of them are still in existence, but a lot of them are. And I'll never forget, you know, every time I'll hear, I guess it's probably true, but for other folks that when you've been at a university, whenever you hear the sort of the fight song at football games, even if you hear like sort of in the background at, you know, when you're watching something on TV or something like that, you'll know the song and it'll be hard not to sing the words to it.
Oh, Tom, any closing comments that you'd like to share?
Oh, I just think that as I remember part of the process here that it's, you know, there's a lot of things you can do at an institution or on a job, but it's the only way you can get it done is sort of through a learning process on the one hand, and also having the cooperation and help of other people. And sometimes you can inspire them and things like that, but you have to also do some of the work. You have to say what you're doing, you know, you have to make sure that you produce yourself. And I think that the cooperative nature of things is what really ends up with a very good product at the end. And I think that's, I've been blessed with having a lot of people here that I've been able to cooperate with and been able to do things with, and it's been great.
Good. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. You're